From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The leftist party Syriza won its second victory of the year in elections in Greece this past weekend. We begin with this report from Press TV's Sheena Shirani.
The head of Greece's left-wing Syriza party, who has won Sunday's parliamentary elections, says he will form a coalition government with the right-wing party, the Independent Greeks. Addressing thousands of jubilant supporters in central Athens, Alexis Tsipras said he's joining forces once again with the Independent Greeks, with whom he governed from January until last month. Panos Kemenos, the head of the nationalist Independent Greeks, joined Tsipras on stage. Official results show with 90% of the votes counted, Syriza had over 35.5% of the vote and 145 seats in the 300-member parliament. The Conservative New Democracy is behind Syriza with 28.05%. The Independent Greeks, meanwhile, are in seventh place with 3.6% and 10 seats. Meanwhile, Syriza's spokeswoman has said the party will implement the bailout agreement it signed with its international lenders.
For a look at what Syriza might have up its sleeve going into the next period, we bring you this pair of interviews from RT, beginning with RT's Katie Pilbeam, who spoke with former member of the European Parliament from Syriza, George Katrugalos.
What choice did the voters really have, though? Because obviously the main rival has very similar stances on the main topics, which of course is austerity, really, isn't it?
No, quite the opposite. We were and we still are against austerity because we are an anti-neoliberalism party. We are against the prevailing neoliberalism at the European level. We have been forced to accept a compromise under a blackmail, but we're still struggling against austerity and for social Europe. And moreover, there is another dividing line between us and the parties of the old establishment. They support the oligarchs and a corrupt political system, and we want to democratize it.
As I understand it, though, Syriza came to power, though, opposing Brussels, right? But only ended up striking a deal. So what went wrong?
The balance of power was tremendously against us. And at the final stage of the negotiation, the European Central Bank refused to increase the liquidity of our banking system and practically forced the banks to close. That was a postmodern coup d'etat, a soft coup d'etat. We have been forced to accept a compromise pushed to us exactly because we wanted to save our country. But we managed to change the long-term dynamics in Europe. Jeremy Corbyn, I suppose, would not be at the power of the Labour if it was not Syriza at the power, exactly as Syriza could not be at the power if there were not the Spanish indignados. So we see at the European level a new left, a radical left, emerging and trying to be not just a power that complains, but a power that can govern.
Okay, George, as I understand it, though, not much has changed, has it? Especially the Greek economy. There's no money, so how can the politics change without the money? Because Greece is still very much reliant on external factors, on external support. So what's the difference?
You are absolutely right. The austerity recipe, it's clear, does not work. We are trying exactly to neutralize the recession elements of the agreement we have signed. We will try to use money promised to us. There is a famous plan Juncker that promised to give us an additional 35 billions of for investments. And we hope, exactly because we are going to follow a different policy than this of the former government, that we can do better.
All right, George. Well, what about the far right and the hard left as well? Because they're both lagging in the polls. They promised to give austerity the boot entirely. What would be the long-term prospects for that?
I don't think they have long-term prospects, even now, at a very ideal for them environment. It's clear that the Greek electorate shows that only Syriza can be a hope for a real change against austerity and for a real democratic political life in Greece. That's one of the positive signs of the elections, that the far right, the neo-fascist party, has been a little isolated. It has not left much of its power, but it is clear that we have stopped its dynamic.
RT's Neil Harvey spoke with a current Syriza member of the European Parliament, Stelios Kouloglou, about the prospects for Greece and for the left across the EU after the weekend victory by Syriza.
Well, I think those are good news for Greek people, but also for the people in Europe. They are suffering from the austerity policies that have been imposed by both Berlin and Brussels. This plan to make of this left six-month parenthesis of the left government of Tsipras failed completely. Because this was the plan that was started from the general elections to overthrow the government, and this plan was supported by the conservative circles in Europe, like Mr. Schäuble, the German Minister of Finance, as well as some Greek politicians of the right. Now, after this new vote, which is very close to the result, the percentage of Syriza will be close enough to the result of January. I think this period finished, and now we have a new stable government tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, and we will try to minimize the bad effects on the agreement of July and maximize some positive aspects. The money will come together.
Stelios, you know, say that it's going to be a stable government, but I mean, a coalition government's a very strong possibility. Is that not going to make life difficult for you to get anything done?
Well, you know, we had a coalition government before, and this was a very stable government concerning the policies that it was about to adopt it. But 40 people, they left, and that's why we had elections. But I think up to the moment, up to the agreement, the government was very stable, and I think it will be a new government with new deputies, and it will be stable enough. Of course, we have to wait and see the final numbers and how much deputies each party will have in the new parliament.
Is Syriza going to be taking a firmer stance against Brussels this time? It sort of built its campaign originally on being anti-austerity. Now you've kind of split to all intents and purposes. Are you going to be tough with Brussels now, or are you going to do what they want?
We will try to change. Everybody agrees, even Germans, that this agreement was a punishing agreement that made things no better for neither for Greece nor for the Eurozone. And all agree they have changes must be made. What we want to do is just to stand by our signature, try to implement the program, but minimize the bad effects. And the bad effect is the recession, because, you know, after 6 years of recession, you cannot have one serious economist in the world that you tell you more austerity is needed. This program, unfortunately, contains more austerity than growth. We need growth. We will try to change the agenda, and we will see what will happen. You know, the good thing is that the New Democracy Party belongs to the old establishment that drove the country to the catastrophe. And now what we can do is, you know, to change, to make reforms concerning the tax evasion problem, to make positive reforms in different aspects of the daily life of the people. And we're going to try to make that and make the difference.
Hace a sus discípulos una pregunta aparentemente indiscreta.
That was Pope Francis in Havana Sunday, speaking at a Roman Catholic Mass before the iconic figure of the famed Cuban revolutionary Ernesto Che Guevara. But although it was a scene celebrated in the West across the media, left out of that narrative was the damage that is still being done by the U.S. economic blockade of Cuba. Che's daughter, Aleida Guevara, refused to attend the mass that the Pope led during his historic Cuban trip, saying it would be hypocritical of her to be present. Speaking with RT last year, she described one instance of U.S. interference in Cuba's trade with other countries.
Cuba decided to buy Ferrari fuel-efficient engines. We were in the middle of negotiations with the company when the FBI found out about this potential deal. The owner of Ferrari received a letter from them in perfect Italian, which I saw with my own eyes. The letter said, "If you maintain trade relations with Cuba, neither you nor your family members will be able to set foot on U.S. territory. If you sell to Cuba, you will not be able to sell any of your products in the U.S. As you can imagine, we never got to purchase a single engine from Ferrari. That was the end of this story. That's the kind of blockade I'm talking about. It's like an older boy trying to take a toy away from his baby brother. I'd go as far as to call it cruel, because the embargo affects even food and medicines."
As war rages in Syria and millions flee to refuge inside and outside of the country, some of those who remain see the country being stripped of some of its best minds, with many whose skills are needed in the country leaving for safer ground.
Europe mainly takes people who are well educated with university degrees, doctors, lawyers, engineers. They are taking the elite of Syrian society. Syria is being depleted of its intellectual wealth.
I don't blame those who have to leave, but I always pray to God that things will improve here and we can stay.
They are making a big mistake. Syria is the best country in the world. Syria is like our mother.
With more on the refugee situation inside and outside of Syria, we bring you this report from RT's Lizzie Phelan, who is in Damascus.
The exodus of Syrian refugees isn't just dividing Europe. 20-year-old twins, Noor and Anas, are also split on whether to stay in their war-torn country or leave, a decision that will mean the two living apart for the first time in their lives.
"I don't think it's worth it for him to make this trip. I hope the war in Syria ends before he travels. I hope it ends in 1 hour."
Noor is preparing to make the treacherous journey to Germany in the winter, the most dangerous time to make the sea crossing from Turkey to Europe that has claimed thousands of lives this year alone.
"I know that these boats are called the boats of death, but I have to consider the dangers of staying here, the mortars and the daily attacks, but this is the only way to make a better life for myself."
"I will be depressed when he leaves. We have a unique relationship. But he thinks he is right, I think I'm right, and we don't seem to be able to find common ground. The war will end at some point, and I think a person's value is measured by how valuable they are to their country and society."
For people who decide to leave and get on buses like this one to begin the first leg of their journey to Europe, there is a growing industry of so-called facilitators, people who help them with everything from the documents that they will need to apply for asylum once they reach their destination to how to avoid being robbed and abused by smugglers on the route.
Adnan, a lawyer by trade, took up facilitating in 2012 when the war began spreading across Syria. This year alone, he's advised 20 people, and in the next couple of weeks has a further 22 in the pipeline. His advice costs on average $400 per client.
"We tell all the people we send that poorer European countries will try to pressure them so they become refugees in Greece, Macedonia, or other poor countries. We tell them, don't accept this. Refuse to become a refugee in these countries. You need to go to a wealthy country."
Even with Adnan's advice and network of contacts, the long road to Europe is still full of dangers. But the tragedy starts at home. For Noor and Anas, the war in Syria means the tearing apart of their bond.
"It will be very difficult, but he will be with me in my heart. His soul is part of my heart, and it will always be with me, even if I am away."
In Damascus, Lizzie Phelan, RT.
A full-page ad was published in last week's edition of the military newspaper Air Force Times, signed by 54 U.S. military veterans, urging U.S. drone operators to refuse orders to fly drone surveillance or attack missions. Air Force Times is a weekly newspaper serving active, reserve, and retired U.S. Air Force and Air National Guard personnel and their families. The ad comes at a time of increasing drone surveillance and attack mission activity now underway in Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, with a recent report by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism indicating that other areas under drone surveillance and potential places of attack include Iran, North and West Africa, Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey, as well as the Gulf states and their territorial waters. Nick Modern is the owner of the website nodrones.org, that's K-N-O-W drones.org. He spoke over the weekend with RT's Mona Zugby.
Over the last several years, we've seen the program of attack and surveillance increase. There are a number of lawyers and military people who feel that these attacks are really violating international law, and in the sense that people's privacy or might be violated 24/7, days on end, many, many people, and then people are assassinated, you know, periodically, and this is done without any due process, so that the drone operators, the military, the politicians are really the judge, jury, and executioner. And this is in violation of any notion of international law, and really undercuts international law in a very broad way in an increasing number of countries. And so, given the fact that the president and the Congress won't act to stop this, we're appealing directly to the people who are being ordered to do the killing and who have to bear the weight of this on their conscience to put a stop to it.
Can I ask you, what are some of the ramifications that members of the military could potentially face when they refuse their missions that are assigned to them?
Well, they could end up in military prison.
Do you think that's a lot to ask?
Well, given what, the experience of people who have signed this letter, including myself, I think that the burden on the conscience can be much, much heavier than serving time in the military prison.
Have you personally received any sort of negative feedback for leading this in any way?
No, I haven't.
Do you feel supported in the decision to sort of urge members of the military?
I do, from other people who have been in the military and who are very enthusiastic about this and who have helped to raise money. I mean, it cost almost $5,000 to run this half-page ad for 1 week. And the vast, amount of that money came from military and ex-military people.
Does their support surprise you? I mean, I'm sure you sort of went into this, and it's probably a very daunting task because you're asking people. Military people are usually, they're very proud and they stand by their orders, and it's something that they pledge to sort of stand by. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you didn't think that you would probably receive the support that you have already.
Well, I guess I should make a little correction. This is, the support has come from people who have been in the military. And I think everybody has a different experience, but I know other people have encountered things where their conscience was definitely, challenged. And I know people who suffer from PTSD because of these experiences. And so I think that having been through that, the idea that everyone who's supported this has is to try to prevent more people from going through it and to prevent more people from being killed because of it. So in that sense, I'm not surprised. I think it's a very big mistake to view the military group as having one mind, one attitude. There's the same variety of experience and thinking and independence that there is in the general population. And understanding that, and understanding that we have had military people who did act on their conscience, like Chelsea Manning, and their drone operators have acted on their conscience. There are a number of people who, because they listened to their soul, have benefited thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people by what they've revealed and what they have decided they aren't going to participate in.
Speaking about drone operators that operate on their own conscience, I know that The Nation published an article about the decline of drone operators, the decline of recruits. What does that say to you?
Well, there are two things. One, this work is very tedious. It involves sitting hours on end in front of computer screens. It means increased hours on the job because of the increased demands that the politicians are making on drone operators to now fly in Syria. And I read an article that suggests they may be flying over Egypt as well as Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Iraq. So just in terms of the workload and the tedium and the stress, it would make somebody want to quit. And then you add on to that that in the United States, the drone operators will go home to their families. And so that's, they're really being asked to live in two different worlds that are very much in contradiction of one another. Most people in this country, I found, and you know, speaking on the street and audiences, have no idea what drone warfare is, have very little idea of what military drones are. And so the people who do this are in a very isolated population where they really, they're not supposed to talk about it, but they really couldn't find people who would really understand what their experience is by and large. So these are all things that make it difficult. It's also difficult to advance in the ranks compared to other types of pilots. And then you put on it that there is PTSD among those people to a certain degree, and that is not being properly addressed by the Air Force in any way whatsoever.
Do you think that some military members simply don't have the knowledge about what the job really is or how it will really affect them?
I think that's absolutely true, and I think that when I went to, for an example, when I was in the Navy and I volunteered to go to Vietnam in 1961 before the war really became what it was to be, I believed every bit of propaganda that the government put out about that war, that I was fighting communism to keep it from taking over Southeast Asia and then, you know, the world. And I think when people are put behind these video screens with, you know, for drone surveillance and killing, they're told that they're fighting terrorists who may one day attack the United States. The deeper reality, in my opinion and other people, that they are really embarked on a struggle for economic and political control in the Middle East and in these countries where they're operating. And that corporate interests in terms of oil, minerals, and water, other things, land, come into play in the decisions about where we will try to exert our control. Terrorism is the selling point that I believe is a myth. And I think that these people who have signed this letter went through very similar experiences than the one that I, you know, to the one that I went through, where they were told one thing and then, you know, very sadly, in some cases tragically, found out that they had been misinformed.
Do you think that there's a growing awareness about civilian casualties in the military? I know that you said that, you know, they can sort of, military members, pilots will, they can essentially fly a drone and not sort of understand that they're going to kill these innocent casualties. I just don't understand. Basically, I don't understand the disconnect. I mean, when you know you're killing a child, like, I know that you said that they could be operating under the misconception that it's a terrorist, but isn't it clear that they're killing children and women and wedding parties and that sort of thing?
Well, I think that, I mean, there are two parts to this. First of all, everyone who is killed by a drone is, in a court of law, a civilian in that they've been found guilty of nothing, okay? Second part is that I think when you're put in that situation, you're told that the target, whoever it is so important that if from time to time women or children or elderly people will die, then that's an unfortunate collateral damage. Now, it's also very clear from the weapons that are used that when a missile hits, many people will die, because a Hellfire missile is made for use against armored vehicles and trucks and buildings. And so when you fire it at a pickup truck, a Jeep, people in the open, people will be just pulverized in a wide area. It can go up to, I think for the Marines, I think that Marines aren't supposed to be anywhere closer than 300 yards from where a Hellfire missile strikes, at 3 football lengths of a field. So people firing these weapons, if they don't understand that there will be unintended killings, it's because they have chosen to block that out of their minds. After a while, it becomes less and less possible to block those things. And I think what this ad is trying to do is to say, look at this now, understand the consequences, and, you know, follow your conscience and do the right thing.
And do you personally think that a drone or a drone, the existence of a drone pilot, can ever be a positive thing in terms of precision or new technology, or do you think that it should just be done away with?
I think it should be done away with, because I think in a certain respect it's like torture. It's an act that is based completely on the violation of people's privacy in many, many, in some cases, in some areas, hundreds, other cases, thousands of people. And there's a study that was just published by a group called Al-Karama, which is a human rights organization, of drone activity over Yemen. And what they found was that there was a widespread reporting of emotional illnesses, of anxiety, simply because people were living in areas where drones were flying and had killed.
So it's not just the pilots, it's actually the people that are on the ground as well.
Absolutely, because if you are living in a situation where you know that someone has been killed by a drone and you can, hear them, or sometimes they're too high, you can't hear them. But if you know that this is an area where they're operating every single day, day in and day out, people sometimes don't leave their homes, don't go to school, don't hold meetings. It totally changes the culture and the life of the community of many, many people. And this is something that is now spreading. The drone presence is now spreading into Northern Africa, as well as countries we consider to be, war zones in the Middle East. And so it makes the world and it makes people feeling that they're always under watch and always may be killed. And that's something that people in this country couldn't tolerate.
Are you hopeful that the drone operations will end? Is that the end goal for you?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that if it becomes harder and harder for them to fly these missions because people don't want to do it for any number of reasons, they're going to have to reevaluate this. Now, it is also true that there is technology being developed that will enable drones to identify people through facial recognition, computer imagery, and to fire automatically on people. And so there is the technology to eliminate the human factor, to take the human soul out of this equation. And that's another reason why this whole thing should be banned. And really, the United Nations should take this up as a world threat in the same way that they've looked at landmines and poison gas and atomic weapons, because the future of this is really terrifying, I think, for people all over the world who suddenly find themselves within the gaze for reasons that they're totally ignorant of.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.